From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar.
And this week, we speak with Eric Dreitzer, political commentator and host of the website StopImperialism.org. Eric, welcome back. What's up, brother?
Hey, Don. Missed you last week. Glad to be back.
Yeah, me too. Back with the living.
Yes, exactly.
So, let's see. The ongoing coup in Brazil.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in fact, I think maybe a good introductory comment would be to say that the ongoing coup in Brazil is actually really just a window into seeing an ongoing push by finance capital and the empire to basically reassert control over the whole of Latin America. I mean, that is one of the dominant themes of the last of politics and geopolitics of the last 15 or so years has been the independence in Latin America, the leftward movement of these countries, obviously led by Venezuela and Hugo Chavez for years, and more recently, you know, in other countries as well, in Ecuador and Bolivia, and of course the left social democratic governments in Argentina under Fernandez, and in Brazil under Lula and now Rousseff. All of these developments over the last decade and a half, I think, have been incredibly troubling for the imperial system, for Wall Street, for Washington, for London, for Brussels, and the rest of them. And while the United States in particular under the Bush administration had its energies and attention focused in Iraq and in Afghanistan and the ongoing wars that the U.S. foments in that region, it had allowed Latin America to somehow slip out of its orbit in a lot of ways. And I think that what we're seeing now in Latin America and a number of countries, Brazil, of course, being in many ways the centerpiece, is in fact the reassertion of hegemony by the empire in Latin America. And that, of course, has geopolitical implications for the entire globe.
I mean, that's more or less what we had been discussing in the series we went through over your writings about the response to the rise of multipolarity and the treatment by the Western hegemon of the BRICS and the countries that are the component parts of it. This is sort of the B in BRICS writ large. You have Brazil as the focal point right now, one of the focal points of this pushback by Washington. You have the same thing manifesting in different ways in Argentina and Venezuela, fully expressed in some ways in Honduras and Paraguay and all kinds of other hot spots, like, for example, the peace talks that are ongoing in Colombia. It seems to be like across the entire front, they're pushing back as hard as they can. And that carries with it both some potential for regaining lost ground on the part of Washington and London and Brussels, and also the danger of exacerbating the serious contradictions that exist on the ground that can both benefit that Washington is trying to have benefit and also bedevil them in their attempt to do this.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great point. When we're talking really about, you know, what's come to be known as the Washington Consensus, and the Washington Consensus really wants to see right-wing elites in Latin America regain the control that they had for many decades up until quite recently. And I mean, that is, I think, in essence, what you've seen in a place like Argentina, right? You had the right-wing Mauricio Macri win a very hotly contested, very close election, and immediately upon taking office, stacks the government with basically, a who's who of financier, Wall Street establishment figures to control everything from, you know, the central bank to to the finance ministries and all of the rest of that, and has really moved hard to placate and to kneel before not just Washington, but really Wall Street. I think probably most specifically exemplified by Macri's quick move to settle for 75% of the total debt with Paul Singer, who had basically been more or less extorting money out of the government of Argentina under Cristina Fernandez, who refused to settle this debt with Singer for anything more than what Argentina was settling with others. And so basically over 14 years, Singer and the vulture capitalists that he represents had basically shut Argentina out of global capital markets, of lending and all of the rest of that. Macri comes in, and within weeks, that issue is settled. Paul Singer gets his big payday that he was looking for, and immediately Macri slides right into the what amounts to the leadership role of the right wing in Latin America. Specifically, I mean, if you look at what's happening in Argentina, he's not only moved to pay off Wall Street, he's moving hard against the labor unions, he's moving hard against to implement more austerity measures, he's moving hard to sell off and privatize major segments of the industry, in particular of commodities and of utilities and of things like that. I mean, it's the standard right-wing, you know, neoliberal playbook that we've seen all over Latin America for years now. That's being implemented in Argentina. But to your point, Don, that you said earlier, the danger for the Washington consensus here is a pushback, the mobilization, the galvanizing effect that a Macri in Argentina has on the working class and the mechanisms of the working class, the institutions of the working class. For instance, right now, as we're speaking, we have mass street demonstrations, right, massive strikes ongoing in Argentina against exactly these policies. So that's really, I think, the double-edged sword that you're pointing to here. On the one hand, it is the reassertion of control by Wall Street and Washington. On the other hand, the last 15 years have, in many ways, I think, helped to mobilize and to organize institutions on the left that to a large extent had been, if not totally disorganized, then mostly dormant up until about 15 years ago. So that's the push and pull I think we're seeing in a place like Argentina. And also, we should add, that's exactly what I think the right wing fears in Brazil, yeah, where they're essentially executing a highly unpopular political move. Let's not forget, these right wing leaders all over Latin America, not in Venezuela or Brazil or Argentina or any of these places, are they popular? Not by a long shot. It's more discontent with the current governments that they're capitalizing on. It's not some sort of love for the right wing, not even by a lot of its supporters.
You know, what's interesting is looking even right now, today's report in Reuters, okay, hardly the local edition of Pravda of the Soviet days. Thousands of Argentines took to the streets of the capital Friday to protest the policies of President Mauricio Macri, a taste of the backlash he faces for economic reforms that have swelled the ranks of the poor. Okay, as an accomplished fact, it's presented. And then it details some of that, and it talks about the devaluation of the by sharply devaluing the peso, loosening price controls, and ending utility subsidies since taking office in December, Macri has sent inflation surging, leaving those at the bottom of the economic heap scrambling to pay for their food and gas. At the same time, the business-friendly leader's efforts to trim government payrolls have eliminated thousands, up to 150,000 jobs that could be gone by the end of the year.
Yeah. I mean, none of that should come as a surprise. All of that was easily predictable. You mentioned it. I mentioned it. Many others talked about that this is exactly what would happen, that when they talk about a quote-unquote business-friendly and investment-friendly government and leadership in Argentina, what they really mean is Wall Street-friendly and a vicious enemy of working people and the poor. I mean, that is a fundamental fact. That is exactly how it's playing out in Brazil as well. Remember that we all know that there are elements of the Workers' Party under Lula and Rousseff that were, shall we say, amenable to certain interests of neoliberalism. There's no doubt about that. They engaged in you know, they were looking to negotiate various free trade agreements, and they were looking to basically increase Brazil's footprint in the global capitalist system, but they were unwilling to basically cede their sovereignty to Wall Street. They were unwilling to have the terms of their economic development dictated to them. And that is really, I think, what has brought this this soft coup in Brazil upon the Workers' Party, using this completely fabricated well, maybe not fabricated, but completely distorted issue of corruption, where Rousseff herself is not even implicated in corruption, yet she's being impeached. The Workers' Party represents a segment of the population, the vast majority of the population, who had really been totally disenfranchised and completely marginalized for more than a century in Brazil. Remember, Brazil has a long history of dominance by a very, very tiny ruling elite whose longtime interests have been focused in Europe and in the United States. And it's only a very recent phenomenon, just as in Venezuela, just as in most parts of Latin America, that the majority of people have been represented by a government that they actually voted for. That's what these right-wing elites resent more than anything else. When I was in Venezuela, the kind of vicious racism that you hear from them towards not just the president and the government, but towards the poor, towards working people, that sort of racism and classism that is so deeply embedded on the right in all throughout Latin America, and in particular in a place like Brazil, which is very starkly divided along class lines and skin color lines, we should add. So all of these things, I think, play into it. And that's why the dynamic that's unfolding in Latin America is so, I mean, on the one hand, interesting to watch, but also very disturbing. These trends are very, very frightening.
You know, it's useful for folks that aren't familiar with it too, and even for those of us who have some familiarity with it, to maybe take stock of some of the weight of the history of those countries and the relationship with the United States, particularly the forms and the structures that were used. You have certainly in places like Brazil, which has, by the way, a larger African American population than the United States does, as a legacy of the you know, the transatlantic slave trade. A caste system, essentially, on skin color, that corresponded, of course, to an economic system with the minority white population of Portuguese extraction generally sitting at the top of the heap as a sort of domestic gatekeeper for the U.S. imperialism. The concentration of ownership of local industry, either in the hands of the state, which is in turn in the hands of private industry, and then, you know, all the actual real assets contracted out, or in the hands of this small elite, including the media in particular, and enforced by either a direct military dictatorship or a militarist state. Same condition prevailed in Argentina, in Chile. In fact, we saw that reimposed by Kissinger and Nixon and such in 1973 there. Throughout the region. And it was against this background, with a complete impoverishment of masses of people of the region, cooking underneath all of that, requiring the like total control over information flow in the form of the media and the militarist social and domestic policy and such, required in order to maintain the conditions that were so oppressive that they would, you know, provoke a revolution in Iraq, basically. Well, finally, you saw this upsurge that took place really across the region, beginning more or less becoming manifest with Chavez taking power in 1998 in Venezuela, and the cobbling together of a consensus among countries, regardless of their political and economic systems, of an understanding that our sovereignty and our right to self-determination, those are primary goals that we are going to pursue, to the exclusion of anything contrary, and our own self-development. And that project has been ongoing, and it has been focused on in some places and enabled in others, almost by necessity, a reduction of and elimination in many places of extreme poverty, an amelioration of poverty generally, the construction and or implementation and or improvement of public facilities like education, healthcare, etc., and a sense of empowerment of the working class. 15, 17, 16 years into that, as there was some pushback in the economic sphere because of the economies being heavily reliant on the sale of commodities and a commodities market where the prices were pushed down, depriving some of the governments of the operating capital to continue anti-poverty programs, total information war that's been ongoing without relent, and mobilization periodically of right-wing uprisings and such, and just outright murder death squads and things going on, disruption of the economies in various places by other means. Some folks sat on their hands for a couple of elections, in one in Venezuela and one in Argentina most recently, and that has been seized upon by people like the writers at the New York Times and elsewhere as, well, the tide has turned, the pink tide is now receding, and we're going to see a restoration of conservatism. But that's not really what's happening, is it?
No, I don't think so at all. In fact, I think that the people are still very much, I think, in the ideological camp of anti-imperialism to a large extent. I mean, that was certainly true to the people I talked to in Venezuela, including the people who were very unhappy with the government, including people who were no longer even supporting not just the PSUV, that's the Socialist Party led by Nicolas Maduro, Chavez's successor, the party that Chavez built, but actually weren't even supporting the GPP, the Great Patriotic Pole, which is the coalition of parties of the left, basically. So, you know, these people are still, in their minds at least, very much of an anti-imperialist persuasion, people who see in socialism a chance for a better future and so forth, but who have just become disillusioned. So I don't think that the tide has turned ideologically amongst the people and the grassroots necessarily. I think the mood maybe has changed. But in fact, what I really think is happening is a direct and coordinated push by the ruling establishment in the United States and in the empire broadly to basically seize on this discontent, seize on the exasperated feeling that a lot of people have about corruption and various other things, basically to implement regime change by other means. In other words, where the United States implements regime change by force in Libya, by force in Iraq, by force in, you know, various other parts of the Middle East and actually in Yugoslavia in the late 90s as well, it is implementing it not so much by force in Latin America, but I would say by political maneuvering, by stealth, by utilizing those institutions that you just described, the media, which the right wing still controls mostly, the institutions of the state, which are not directly in the hands of the people and their representatives, the institutions of private capital, the distribution networks, all of the rest of that, using in some cases, particularly in a place like Venezuela, using targeted assassinations, death squads, paramilitary groups, street gangs, a lot of these sorts of manipulations that and machinations that I think have been used to basically position proxies and puppets into power. That's what you're seeing in Brazil. That's what you saw in Argentina. Though it should be admitted, Argentina was on the heels of an election, which by all indications there was not any fraud that we know of necessarily. But as you were alluding to, Don, and this is an important point, in Argentina, Macri won by less than 2%. Less than 2%. And you had some segments of the left who were unwilling to support Cristina Fernandez's party, what are they called, the Justicialist party. They were unwilling to support them and their quote-unquote Peronist policies because they saw them as bourgeois social democrats at best.
Right. And not radical enough.
Not radical enough, exactly. Right. And this is the first of all, this is the danger in Latin America of that kind of left sectarianism, which I don't think applies in the United States, where the political system is vastly different, where the distinctions between left and right are, at least on the mainstream side, are almost blurred. They're blurred at best and completely irrelevant at worst. In Latin America, it's very, very different. There are clear differences between left and right, clear differences between who the left represents and who the right represents. And those differences are deeply embedded in the social and cultural and, of course, economic fabric of these countries. So, you know, on the one hand, you know, there is this sense that the U.S. is kind of implementing these, you know, these changes by stealth. But actually, and this is the other point I want to make, this is very much in keeping with U.S. policy in Latin America generally. I mean, we know the period of the dirty wars, right? The dirty war in Argentina, the disappearances, the dictatorship, which is all declassified now. The U.S. was involved in orchestrating it and supporting it. The U.S. was involved in orchestrating and supporting the dictatorship that took power in Brazil in 1964. Yep. The U.S. obviously, as we all know, was involved in the overthrow of Allende and the establishment of the Pinochet dictatorship in Chile.
Go back to our bends, of course.
I mean, I haven't even touched Central America. Yeah, of course. Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador, all of these places, the U.S. has done these sorts of things. And so there's various tools in the imperial toolkit. Right. Sometimes it's death squads. That's what we see in the Middle East. That's what we see in Syria. That's what we saw in Libya. Sometimes, and of course, historically in Central America and in South America, sometimes it's just pure dictatorships, the establishment of dictatorships. And sometimes it's something in between. And I think that this soft coup strategy that's being employed in Brazil, just like what we're seeing in Venezuela, is part of a coordinated campaign to basically position the old ruling class back into power.
And, you know, so now they come into power. And, you know, of course, history doesn't stop, it doesn't end, forgetting Frankie. And
Frankie Fouque?
Yeah. And so they have to move forward. So you have, for example, in Argentina, you know, you have a almost a discreet picking apart of the coalition behind the governing party, the peeling off, say, of a little bit of the vote from the left, taking a hard left position, saying we're going to sit on our hands. What information war, whatever things can be done to seat Macri in the presidential palace. Now he takes power on a hopey-changey kind of very vague platform, not saying we're going to go back to the days of the disappearing and all of that, not saying we're going to remove the basic guarantees of food, shelter, health care, etc., that you have acquired over the last 12 years, not saying any of that, just things are going to be better, goes into office before Congress convenes, inflates the currency, starts massive layoffs and firings, attacks the media law that had allowed some diversity of media in the country, goes, you know, all out and makes a major attack. And now the people, you know, today, this is April, this is 5 months after the election, the people are in the streets already. And you have that same condition prevailing everywhere. On the one hand, the United States has, I believe, sees itself, or the elites here see themselves, looking at a closing window of opportunity to reverse the trend towards multipolarity generally and the rise of sovereign nations in this hemisphere and such, and the consolidation of a bloc, whether it's UNASUR, SALAC, whatever, of nations here with a 600 million person market and all of the wealth that's there. And so they have to push. In addition, their objective needs are for broader and deeper exploitation of resources. I mean, you're in what looks like end-stage capitalism, where they need to really suck that blood really hard. And so that has to be driving part of their policy. And the conditions may not be right on the ground for that. And we're starting to see some examples already of the pushback happening pretty early in the game.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you kind of bring me to, I should have been plugging this from the beginning, but I have a new article that was published while we're speaking here on April 30th, or I guess May 1st, I had an article published just in the last 24 hours or so. This is on Telesur. I'm sure it'll be published elsewhere. Hillary Clinton and Wall Street's Neoliberal War on Latin America.
It's at telesurtv.net.
Yes, thank you. Telesurtv.net/English. Basically, and, you know, I get into a lot of specifics here, some of which I've already talked about. But the point that I want to make, and this is really what you're getting at, I think, is that there are two, planes on which we need to understand what the United States and the empire's elites are really doing. On the one hand, as we've been talking about, it's reasserting their political control. But as you're getting at, Don, and you're absolutely correct, it's really also about economics, right? And those two things, of course, being directly interrelated. And so, yes, it's about this sort of nakedly neo-colonial desire to continue extracting wealth, right? Obviously, Venezuela's oil is well known. Less well known is the fact that Argentina actually has vast reserves of energy that are mostly untapped, that they're huge proven reserves that are in Argentina that a lot of very interested parties would love to get their hands on. That's something that Macri has talked about doing actually quite considerably. You want to get about specifics about his platform. He said, we want to bring investment. In other words, we want to let the empire extract wealth out of Argentina as much as possible in order to line our pockets and enrich ourselves and our friends. Right. So the commodities issue, that is, of course, central to all of this. But there's another angle here that really, I think, is underreported and very little discussed. And that is the fact that the installation of these right-wing leaders, in particular someone like Macri, is the vehicle by which the United States is going to implement the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Transatlantic Partnership, TPP and TTIP, in Latin America. That is how it's going to be done. The main obstacle to implementing these things has been Dilma Rousseff and the Workers' Party in Brazil, who don't want to do it on the U.S.'s terms, Cristina Fernandez in Argentina, who wouldn't even hear of it, and in Venezuela and in a few other countries as well. All of these countries have really made it impossible for the United States to implement this grander strategy of so-called free trade, which is, in effect, the expansion of the U.S. sphere of influence and corporate control over these various sovereign nations. So Macri said just actually quite recently and over the course of the last few months, multiple times, that one of the things he wants to do is he wants to use Mercosur, okay, which is a very important regional organization. Mm-hmm. He wants to use Mercosur as the vehicle for bringing about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. In other words, he wants to bring Latin America on board of the Trans-Pacific Partnership beyond just Chile and Peru and Mexico, who are already signatories to it, but actually the rest of Latin America, using Mercosur as the vehicle or the conduit to do that. Simultaneously, he has basically said the exact same thing about TTIP. In other words, and the way that he frames it, bringing European capital to Latin America, bringing quote unquote investment into Latin America. So you can see what's happening here. It's not just reasserting control over Argentina or reasserting control over Brazil. It's putting in place the bankers' boys, the Wall Street puppets, the proxies, who will then utilize the mechanisms of the state and these regional cooperation organizations in order to bring about this massive neoliberal architecture. And as you were alluding to, Don, and you're again correct, this is not simply about bringing them back into the fold of the U.S. This is about depriving China in particular of these increasingly important Latin American allies. So while China's economy slows down, China's still flush with cash. China still has plenty to invest. China still wants to invest in Latin America. How are are they going to be able to do that when you have basically this firewall of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and TTIP really kind of pushing Latin America by hook or by crook towards the U.S. and Europe? That aspect of this, I think, is critical to understand. That's why Wall Street is so interested in this. It's not simply about political control. It's about corporate hegemony in Latin America and against China and, to a lesser extent, Russia.
Yeah, it's a part of the global game as well. I mean, what we're talking about when we spoke about and when we speak about the rise of multipolarity and point to the BRICS and SCO and, you know, all the New Silk Road and the Chinese investment in Latin America and all these different things, what we're talking about is the rise of a new global architecture. And what the United States and Europe, or whatever, what the West, what Western hegemony is attempting to do is put its hand in there to reconfigure Latin America into its own block. That's the form that this is taking, and that's the substance of what they're seeking to do. What's interesting, though,
yep,
is that you have at the kernel of this the same contradictions that led to the pushback against the right wing in the first place and the rise of the pink tide, to use the newspaper terminology. Those conditions are not going to go away. If the West is successful in increasing its extraction of value out of Latin America, it will impoverish and radicalize more and more people on the ground in Latin America. And regardless of what the paper says on the treaty and what they sign and everything else, you will have this native instability to the system.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the question is what form of radicalization that would take. I mean, speaking just from my personal experience with Venezuela, for example, I think that there are a lot of the let's say, you know, the groundwork is laid at the grassroots level for a radicalization that's not simply about radicalization of ideology. It'll be about radicalization of tactics, moving away from a state-centered model towards a more cooperative, grassroots, communal-based model, which, you know, without getting into the ideological aspects of, you know, state versus, you know, grassroots communism or whatever, I'm not going to get into that necessarily. Yeah. I mean to simply say that the radicalization is also a decentralization of the socialist ideology towards a more local and, dare I say, more democratic model, which is really what Chavez had wanted and what he advocated, particularly at the end of his life, you know, la comuna o nada, right? The commune or nothing.
That's where Maduro has seen basically his move after the elections in Venezuela going. They've been basically, for example, with the food distribution, that's one of the things that they did was take it out of the hands, to the extent they could reach it, of the corporate elites and start placing it in the hands of community organizations.
Yeah, it's true. But when you the problem is that when you speak to grassroots, you know, activists on the left, socialists and supporters of, you know, Chavez and Chavismo, the Chavistas, they'll also bring up the fact that in the attempts that the PSUV, the Socialist Party, has made to do that, there's been not only a lot of corruption and mismanagement, there's been a lot of blunders. And the problem is that this is what let's just take a historical precedent here, because I'm not trying to, you know, denigrate Venezuela's government exactly. I mean to simply say that there's a psychological component to all of this that the United States and its allies and the right wing in the country exploit. In Nicaragua in the 1980s, when after the Sandinista Revolution in 1979, the seizure of power, it's the fall of the government and the installation of a socialist government there, you had this obviously the Contra War and all of the rest of that. But in the field manual, the CIA's playbook, basically, which is now declassified, you can find it online, they talk about a form of psychological warfare in which they attempt to use and leverage the media, both internationally and within the country, in order to have the people who support the Sandinista government psychologically identify their personal problems with that government. So, lack of food, food is to be directly attributed to the mismanagement of the government,
right.
never to outside forces,
right.
never to
of
the
course.
Control of the distribution networks, the right wing, et cetera, never to the United States and to the economic forms of economic war, always to train it directly on the government. That form of psychological warfare is very much in play in a place like Venezuela. And in fact, that's exactly what they're playing on in Brazil as well. There is a not-so-coincidental correlation between the growing discontent about corruption
right.
in Brazil
right.
and the fall of commodity prices, the fall of revenues, the fall
right.
of a lot of these very important economic indicators. That's what we're seeing playing out. Not just the manipulation of commodity prices, which I do believe is happening, and I think it's demonstrably provable using very clear empirical evidence,
yeah,
but
yeah.
That aside, the collapse of these prices has also led to a crisis of confidence, and that's really what's being exploited here. You can't tell a poor person to care about political ideology and political parties
right.
when their main focus is feeding their children.
Right.
That's what the right wing is cynically exploiting.
Right, and what they've been doing basically is, because they control the narrative almost completely in Brazil, what they've been able to do, I mean, you start with this quote-unquote non-ideological, appellation of corruption, which you bandy about. It's not tied to any factual base, because if you actually look at what corruption means in terms of people benefiting from, sucking the life out of the public trough, benefiting from their position in power and such, it's been the right that's been doing that. They're the ones with the Swiss bank accounts. They're the ones with the corporate shells in Panama, et cetera, et cetera. Rousseff
yep.
is accused of manipulating the books for political gain. I mean, if you were to impute some sort of motive to it, that's the motive that they're imputing. Somehow that is the penultimate corruption, when what she was doing was juggling the books so she could keep feeding hungry people with the money that was coming out of Petrobras. But what they do is they use this to mobilize people to discredit the government, to discredit the institutions that the people themselves have organized or that they've been participating in for all this time. And if you're the only voice speaking at the only microphone in town, some people buy it. At the end of the day, however, you're going to end up in the same place. People, if you use Venezuela as an example, no matter what they sell over the private media in Venezuela, no matter what happens to the food supply or whatever that can be reached and manipulated, the people, the million families that now have housing, are not going to move out of those apartments and let them be sold off as condominiums to people from Florida without a fight.
That's right. Although the danger is that they won't be necessarily forced out. They'll be incrementally pushed out, and that is part of the broader strategy here. Now, in order to resist, of course, you have to have some kind of organization, and that gets back to what we were talking about just a few minutes ago. Organization at the grassroots level. Brazil is an interesting case as well, because, of course, Brazil still has massive poverty. I mean, just horrific poverty that is almost difficult to comprehend for a lot of people. And the thing is, those people, those millions of people living in the favelas and, in the poorer parts of the cities and so forth, they're not particularly concerned about the corruption. If you look at the makeup, I mean, they don't like it, obviously, but I mean, it's not their overriding concern. If you look at the makeup of a lot of these protests and a lot of the organizations, Wall Street funded organizations, I should add,
right.
that have been pushing these protests, they're mostly bourgeois middle class, upper middle class, students that come from affluent backgrounds and so forth. Those
White.
Who are either ideologically enamored with neoliberal capitalism, or those who basically don't know any better and who get caught up in it. There's a lot of that in Venezuela. You had a lot of young people who were against the government during these last elections, mostly because they've never known life before Chavez.
Right.
They didn't know what it was like, 30 years ago. A lot of the older people, older supporters of the left in Latin America understand perfectly the danger of the right wing. And let's not lose site, of course, of Wall Street here. Wall Street is central to all of this. All of the policies that, Don, you were talking about, Macri implementing in Argentina, those are the exact same policies we'll see in Brazil. Why? How do we know this? Because not only do we have a historical record of that, right, we know who's going to be in the very leadership positions that will be making these decisions. Just one example that I explain in my article. In Brazil, we already know that the makeup of a future cabinet and future government under the vice president, assuming Rousseff is removed from power. So this would be Vice President Michel Temer, okay? And Temer is already prepared with his cabinet ready to go. And who is going to be either the finance minister or the head of the central bank? A guy named Paulo Leme. Oh, what's Paulo Leme's previous job? Chairman of Goldman Sachs in Brazil. The main operative that Goldman Sachs has in the country, one of the preeminent voices of Wall Street in Latin America. He will be leading the largest, most significant country politically and economically in Latin America, given a potential impeachment. We see the same exact thing in Argentina with Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, HSBC, Barclays, all of these banks. Their people or former employees of these companies, and of course you're never former finance capital, you're always finance capital once you're in that class. These are the people who are going to be making these decisions. So it's no accident here. You talk about inflation going out of control. They don't care about prices going up for the poor. That's not who they represent. That's not the class interest that they have. That's how we know what's happening in Latin America. And I think that that's really why we have to look at countries like Ecuador and Bolivia and Nicaragua and even Venezuela. All of these countries are facing a wide array of forces that are going to be lined up against them. And this is really, I think, the fundamental question for the coming years in Latin America is how is the left, which really represents the vast majority of the people in Latin America, how is the left going to respond to this obvious move? None of what we're saying here, Don, none of this is a secret to the people of Latin America, people who are at least somewhat politically informed. They know this, and they know this better than most leftists in the United States and in the West do. Why? Because this is a retread of the same imperialist strategy.
Yep, absolutely. It's a replay of their history. They've seen
this
happen.
That's exactly right. They've lived this before.
In the 1930s, you saw this in the region. In the 1950s, you saw this in the region. Yep. In the 1970s, you saw this in the region, and you're seeing it again.
Yep, that's exactly right. And you know, the question, I think, before a lot of the activists and politically minded leaders in the grassroots and also in leadership positions, the question is, how do you organize yourselves in order to respond? Because frankly, I think if we take a sober assessment of the last 15, 16 years, a lot of very significant mistakes have been made, mistakes that maybe were unavoidable. I suppose it's debatable. You know, I make no secret about my undying, you know, fondness of Hugo Chavez and everything that he represents. He's one of the main reasons that for my own political awakening, you know, years ago now. But Chavez didn't, you know, have a career without mistakes, without major mistakes. And I think some of those came back to bite him. Some of them have come back to bite Latin America generally. And of course, it's not on Chavez alone. You know, this is true of the entire region. As you mentioned, private control of the distribution networks, still remaining the private control of the media, which is predominantly right wing. These are fundamental levers of power, institutions that have to be seized and controlled by forces that are not allied with Wall Street and with the Washington consensus, but are rather serving the people. How that is going to be done? Well, that's something that I think that is the subject of debate. But this is what people in Latin America are talking about. And from my perspective, for people on the left in the US and in the West broadly, our mission is to find ways to support these initiatives, to support these grassroots movements and grassroots activism in order to reassert the control and the power of people in Latin America against this push, which is obviously taking place before our eyes.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the media, for example. On the one hand, you saw moves, you know, that were made by Chavez, Fernandez, you know, across the region, where the creation of government media in Venezuela, a public media, a democratic media also on the ground, grassroots, you know, you had newspapers and radio stations and things.
I just said my article is published in Telesur. There's a good example.
And also the fact that the right has not been shy at all. I mean, when they did the coup in Venezuela in 2002, for example, they bombed the damn public TV station. Macri wasn't in for 10 minutes before he's looking to pull the media law that enabled public radio stations, community radio stations, pull out of Telesur. All of that happens right away. They understand exactly the value of maintaining their total spectrum dominance across the media. And to me, it's also seemed like, why be shy about it? Just nationalize the damn media and hand it out to the people. But, you know, you can't move against imperialism on all fronts from a place like Venezuela or Argentina or whatever. And so I also understand the, you know, attempts to do this incrementally, but
for sure, no doubt. And believe me, what I'm saying is not some kind of attack on Chavez. That would be in many ways unthinkable for me. What I mean to say is that the situation in Latin America after more than a century, and in fact, we could go much further than that and say, you know, five centuries of colonialism in the region, that's not something that can be undone overnight, let alone in 15 years. It's something that will take a lot of time. And again, I mean, one of the things that we always should remember is that Castro himself said to Chavez at some point, now whether this is apocryphal or whether this is actually happened, I don't know. But the story goes that Castro himself said to Chavez that a Cuban-style revolution was not feasible in the 21st century in Latin America. And there's a lot of reasons why. I mean, for one thing, the Bolivarian Revolution was happening at a time when there was no Soviet Union. There was no socialist bloc of countries. There was no alternative to the global capitalist system. And so to move on all fronts, as you were saying, and just nationalize the media, nationalize all of these industries would have been to basically provide the pretext to completely isolate Venezuela politically, economically. It would have prevented Venezuela from really pushing the creation of ALBA and CELAC and all these other organizations, because it would have essentially been blockaded and cut off from the rest of the region. So I understand a lot of the contradictions and a lot of the difficulties and why the incremental move. But of course, the drawback of that is 15, 16 years after Chavez comes to power, after the commencement of the Bolivarian Revolution, here we are talking about, will it survive another 6 months? Will it survive another year? Will the right wing be in power this time next year all over Latin America? I mean, that is a very dangerous prospect, and one that, if I could do just one other plug here, one that I will be discussing on two different panels at the Left Forum coming up in New York City, I want to say May 19th. I think that's right. The weekend of May 19th. If you're around New York City, you should come to that. Check out these panels. It'll be fun.
You know, and there's a dialectic around that whole question as well. Not of the Left Forum. We could go there too, but
there's a dialectic around that too.
But around the idea of incrementalism, because with Chavez not going, all out, let's nationalize everything in sight, et cetera, et cetera. What he was able to do was cobble together, essentially, ultimately, UNASUR and CELAC, saying, you know, a multiplicity of systems, whatever you guys want to do on your territory is fine. Let's be friends. Let's work together. Let's protect each other's back. And that has been the real strength also of what Chavez set in motion in Venezuela. And if he had acted in a way that wouldn't allow, say, a right-wing government in this country or that country to enter into trade agreements with Venezuela, to accept Petrocaribe or other groupings like this, to sit down and formulate UNASUR and all of that, you know, you might not have the level of integration that you have, which was achieved by respecting this multiplicity of systems.
I totally agree with that. I think that that's true. Of course, since you said dialectic, the opposing question that needs to be addressed is also, what are the drawbacks of that system?
Of
what is the drawback of Venezuela funding a lot of these things with oil revenue? Well, it means that 15 years after the revolution, Venezuela's revenues are 95% still dependent upon oil. In other words, that it has an incredibly one-dimensional economy that now I think Maduro and the current government is desperately trying to diversify as much as possible, but not something that can be done overnight. And the problem is, to diversify it in order to, a stopgap measure means moving towards other exploitative industries like mining and, various other things like that. So there is this question about what is the way forward, Lenin's famous what is to be done, right? And
yeah.
I think the what is to be done right now is in Latin America is really on two fronts. On the one hand, we have to stop this neoliberal assault on the entire region, stop the implementation and imposition of the TPP, the TTIP, these free trade agreements, stop the soft coup in Brazil, all of these things. And then the secondary, or not secondary, but simultaneously, the question of how to organize in order to reassert control, not simply by putting in place, the right president, reassert control by fundamentally reorganizing the institutions of power in the country, the media, the food system, distribution of consumer goods, commodities, all of that. This large question is probably the biggest question of all. That's what really needs to be discussed, and I think it is being discussed at the grassroots level in Latin America. It's what's being discussed among the allied governments, and this is what people on the left in the West, and particularly in the global North, really need to be aware of. Our responsibility is to help foster these sort of global South cooperation, global South initiatives, so that they can stand independent of this imperial global system. All systems can be undermined. It's just a matter of how.
On that point particularly, I guess, and we could close with this, in terms of our responsibility, I mean, this assault, the interests that are conducting this assault are domiciled here. Their power base is here. Their institutional power base, their military power base, their economic power base here and in Western Europe. We have a responsibility, a large responsibility in terms of this, trying to pull these people off the necks of the people in the global South. And I'm wondering, forgetting all of the warts, and which I'm as familiar with as you are, of say Sanders and even Trump, the political focus on these treaties, does that give us some leverage to pull back some the ability of the elites here to conduct this war, which really is led by the attempt to knot everybody up into more of these treaties?
Well, trying to not be too cynical.
No, forgetting what the intention is of any of those parties. We have movements that are being expressed through them. The reason that, giving the most cynical view of whatever comes out of Sanders' mouth, and certainly an accurate one of what comes out of Trump's mouth, are based on things that they have identified as political sentiments that are among the masses in this country. Is there some way of focusing that anti-TPP, anti-TTIP, anti-NAFTA, etc. sentiment to help get breathing room for Latin America?
Well, there's a great responsibility that for somebody like a Sanders has. I'll leave Trump aside for just a second. There's a great responsibility that Sanders has to do exactly that. Sanders has created a more or less a movement. I don't want to get into the definitions of what exactly is a movement, but let's just call it a movement.
I don't know about who created what either, because egg issue.
Okay,
there,
let me put it this way: Sanders has galvanized a movement. Sanders is the pole around which a movement has been organized, and that movement, Sanders has a very important responsibility to push that movement forward and to push it even further in a progressive direction. Now, there's talk about the creation of a Sanders-Jill Stein Green Party alliance that could really move towards creating a new political party, a party of the 99%, whatever. Whether that's pie in the sky or not, I'm not really here to make a judgment on that. Right. But I do think that the organization and the let's call it the consolidation of a broad-based movement against things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and free trade generally, against Wall Street, against all of that, that is the from the activist side, that is the responsibility here in the United States. That's what we need to be doing. And so this is really the question before Sanders supporters, that your responsibility is to get your guy, Sanders, to really understand the historical, the world historical importance of this moment and of pushing his followers and this movement, which is, you know, in many ways just beginning in that direction. Simultaneously, Trump, I'm much more skeptical about Trump's actual beliefs on the issue of free trade, because Trump's comments that everybody points to about the Trans-Pacific Partnership are complete BS, because he actually said he opposes the Trans-Pacific Partnership because it coddles China, because it's good for China, which is, of course, completely the opposite of the reality. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is designed as a weapon against China, and it doesn't benefit them in any way. It hurts them, actually, significantly. So is Trump really opposed to free trade?
Doesn't matter. I mean, what I'm looking at more is the reason that he's mouthing these things is because it's drawing him support among the white working class who have been victimized like everyone
else.
What I'm talking about is, so if we are going to try to attain breathing space for the people in Latin America, we look outside the convention in Cleveland, and there is in the midst of all of the maniacs there wearing God knows what, the sheets and everything else, there is a mass of white workers who know that the reason they're in the condition they're in is because of these trade treaties, so they are instinctively opposed to it, organizing them and going outside of Philadelphia, where another mass of working people, not quite so white there, have exactly the same opposition. Can we assemble somehow a power base among them to buy some breathing space for the people of Latin America and elsewhere?
Well, I mean, you can do it on the right, you can talk about free trade and whatever, you know, as much as you want. The problem is that a lot of their anger is directed, in regard to Latin America, is obviously racist inherently, and they don't particularly care much for Latin America. What they're interested in, I get what you're saying, Don, is their jobs and their jobs being outsourced and all of the rest of that. The problem is that as soon as you talk about the actual issue that is driving all of this, that is capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, the light goes off, right? Yeah. So what you're talking about is finding a way to appeal to what has now become, what didn't used to be this way, but what has now become an instinctively reactionary white working class on the right in particular, and orient them against what is in effect the consensus among the right. And that is neoliberal capitalism. So that contradiction, I think, has to be played out even further. And how is that done? Well, look, I think the bottom line is I personally am very skeptical of so-called left-right alliances. I at one time believed that that was an important tactic that needed to be implemented. I now am kind of on the other side of that issue because I've seen examples of that, and every time it's tried and the disaster that emerges from it. So I think that there is something here, and there's something to what you're saying. The question is how that is to be done. When Trump talks about protectionism and, you know, protectionism and tariffs and all of the rest of that, this is, of course, great. How is that going to be implemented? That's not so clear. Trump obviously can't do that. Trump wouldn't do that. It's not even in his own personal business interest to do that. But is there a sentiment among working people, left and right, of against free trade? Of course. How is that capitalized on? Not clear, at least not yet.
Okay, and on that note, Eric, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thanks a lot, Don. Always my pleasure.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host, and look forward to seeing you again next week.